For the week of November 19th, 2017, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 389, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Allentown, Pennsylvania, I had to think about that, I'm Michael Giltz.
Why did you have to think about it? You travel so much you don't know where you are.
Exactly. I'm heading down to Nashville for Thanksgiving.
Ah, okay.
But I'll be back in Allentown for next week's show, if we have a show.
Well, yes, of course, you may hear some construction going on, over the past few shows and during this one. And that's because they're constructing right above the studio. And now, next week, they move into the studio. So I don't know where I'm going to be. I have to find a place.
We may miss a week, though. It's an important time with the Thanksgiving box office and all the excitement going on with Hollywood.
That's true. Well, by excitement, come on. I mean, I hope
making
you're...
Making money.
Oh, okay. I thought you were referring to something else.
No. It's a good Thanksgiving for Taylor Swift. Her final figures are in. She sold 1.28 million physical copies of her album. And we haven't even hit the gift buying season yet. So that's exciting. We got Black Friday coming. And of course, Thanksgiving through Christmas and New Year, Hollywood just rakes in the money hand over fist. A lot of big movies coming out, and it'll be fun to see how they do.
Yeah, I guess her previous album, the one with Shake It Off, the name of which I am now forgetting, wasn't it just Taylor Swift? I don't know. I'm sure I'm embarrassing myself to all the Swifties out there. But that one sold 1.3 million copies in its first week, and this is right up there with it.
Absolutely. Yeah, so it's a big success story for her, and I'm sure she'll want to listen to the show to find out how we cover it. If she does listen in, what else will she hear about?
Well, this week on Showbiz Sandbox, we'll talk about lawsuits. Suing someone is Hollywood's second favorite pastime, right after wondering whose vile behavior will finally come back to haunt them. The hit TV show Supernatural is apparently losing money after years on the air. Director George Miller, he says his film did not go over budget. Not really. And he's suing Warner Brothers. Where is all the money going these days in Hollywood? Don't worry, Columbo is on the case. On Inside Baseball, we're announcing a new branding effort. From now on, Inside Baseball will be called Dear God, Is There Anyone in Hollywood and Washington Who Hasn't Done Something Shameful? In other words, the latest on sexual misconduct and the dangers of tweeting. We're looking at you, Lena Dunham. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right, and we're looking at box office around the world. We have a link to ComScore in our show notes. We also pull info from Box Office Profit, Box Office Mojo, Variety, Hollywood Reporter, the LA Times, the New York Times, and you, our listeners. And the number one movie around the world is Justice League. This is the DC version of The Avengers. All the big heroes come together. $281 million worldwide on its opening weekend. It's a disaster.
Yes, because it only earned $96 million here in the United States, and everybody, at least in Hollywood...
Actually, it's $94 million. It came in even lower than the lowered expectations.
Even more of a disaster then, although you will be incredibly happy, Michael. Over on Celluloid Junkie, shameless plug there, Jim Amos actually goes on a whole two paragraphs, maybe even three, about exactly what you're saying, which is... Okay, so it only made $96 million, now $94 million in the United States. Did you see its worldwide gross? Because that's nothing to be ashamed of.
Right, and he's correct, and we'll have to see where it ends up. The Justice League movies have made slightly more, I should say the DC Universe movies, have made a little bit more overseas than in North America, sometimes a fair amount more, but not a huge multiple more. So maybe this is going to be the one to change things. But it is still a little shocking that leading up to this movie, they end up with the lowest gross for any opening weekend of any of the DC films. So that's kind of amazing how poorly it did. And they're talking about the tracking. The tracking said $110 million. That was what they thought like a week or a few days out. Then it was 96. Now it's 94. So the tracking is off. And then we have another film we'll get to called Wonder, where the tracking was way off in the positive end. And I'm thinking what we should say here is that tracking simply can't account for whether a movie is good or not. The buzz can sort of hurt it, but basically, once people start to see it on Thursday night or on Friday, word of mouth gets out. And clearly with Justice League, people weren't happy with what they saw.
Well, and part of the algorithm that they use is is the audience aware? Does the public know about a specific movie? What they, you know, another part of that question is, will you go see that movie? So what they've done over the years is they know, well, you know, we, out of the 10 people we've asked the question of, and I picked a number out of a hat, out of the 10 or 100 people we've asked the question of, you know, 50% know about the movie, and of that 50%, 25% are going to go see the movie, but we know it will actually wind up being 29%. So there's an algorithm that they use to help track. But in this case, I think what they didn't put into that algorithm was, hey, another superhero movie coming out 2 weeks prior to that.
Yeah, that was, I think it was, that was unusual how close they came together. Somebody pointed out this is the first time that two of these big DC or Marvel movies came out within just 2 weeks of each other. And for whatever reason, Thor Ragnarok isn't that good, but people liked it. Whereas Justice League was bad. They mentioned that it had a dire B+ cinema score, whatever that's called, which tells you how meaningless that is. If anything below an A or an A- is dire, you know, kind of a dumb metric, isn't it? B+, B, B-, C+, C. Anything below an A- is a disaster. So that tells you something. So yeah, Justice League opened. They can't be thrilled, but it's made $285 million worldwide. Maybe the people overseas will like it more than they did in North America. Had a good opening in China. We'll have to see where it ends up. But it's certainly a respectable start. If word of mouth tails off very quickly, it could be of trouble. We don't normally talk about tripling your worldwide opening weekend because movies don't usually open this wide. But since this is in most major territories, the rule of thumb is that you might triple your budget, you know, might triple your gross, your opening weekend gross. That's sort of a very rough word of mouth idea. If they end up at $750 million, they won't be thrilled because it costs $250 million to make, but at least it won't be a financial disaster.
Plus, they get all of the, you know, spinoffs and all of the toys and merchandise and ancillary, right? Yeah, they'll be just fine.
Well, if that's where they end up. Though, of course, you know, the comparison is the Avengers, which exploded in popularity, all the Marvel movies.
Right.
And they're launching three new characters. They're launching Aquaman, The Flash, and Cyborg, or whatever that guy's called. So those guys are getting their solo movies. So again, it doesn't help when you make bad movies. They finally made a good one with Wonder Woman, or at least one that people enjoyed a lot. The others have all been commercially successful, don't get me wrong. But Wonder Woman finally gave them like, hey, people are actually excited to see your movies rather than dutifully seeing them. And they come out with this, which cost $250 to $300 million to make, is launching three new characters, and is the lowest opening weekend gross in North America. There's no way to say that's anything but not good news.
Well, what I would say is keep in mind, remember, Zack Snyder also kind of left the film during post-production. So, and I think it was Joss Whedon that came in to kind of finish the film up. So in a way, if they can actually make $750 million with this film, I think Warner Brothers should feel very happy.
Well, you know, Zack Snyder hasn't made good movies, so that his being in or out didn't really, to me, affect, you know, it added to the budget cost a little bit for sure.
Right.
They did a lot of rewrites and a lot of reshooting. And number two around the world is the happier story, Thor Ragnarok. $45 million on the weekend, $740 million worldwide. This one cost only $180 million, so that's well into profitability. And number three is Murder on the Orient Express. As we would expect for an older skewing title, it's having good legs. $35 million on the weekend, $150 million worldwide. So it's already a success story at the box office. And of course, it's got a long way to go. Now, here's a really good story. It's Wonder, a heartwarming drama based on the best-selling kids book. This was tracking at like $13 million or something like that, and it opened up to $27 million worldwide, most of that coming from North America. So that's a huge success story. Julia Roberts is in a supporting role. It's about a little kid trying to mainstream into public school who has a facial deformity from some illness. It's sort of like Mask in a way, but it's a lot more happy and heartwarming and kid-friendly.
Yeah, I don't know why the tracking on this was as off as it was, and here's why. This is based on a best-selling book that is taught in schools that, you know, is geared definitely toward middle schoolers that are going to go with their parents. It was tracking at $9 to $11 million the week of Thanksgiving. So there's a lot of kids that are off and can go see movies all the way to Sunday evening. You know, we went at a 7:30 showing. I took the kids to go see this movie, and the theater was packed and everybody was crying because it's kind of a tearjerker, and everybody loved the film, and everybody had read the book, and entire classes were going to see this movie. So school, you know, there were field trips to go see this movie.
Schools went on a field trip to see a movie?
You know, there was certain anecdotal evidence that that has had occurred.
Why?
Well, because they had read the book.
I understand, but why would they do a field trip to go see a commercial release?
I have no idea.
That seems a bizarre waste of school energy. Go to a science museum. But anyway, yeah, so it did terrifically well on opening weekend. It cost about $20 million to make, so it's already looking like a really strong success story. We'll have to see how it does in other territories where perhaps the book isn't as well known. But yeah, it's a very popular middle grade book. And number five is Daddy's Home 2, another $14 million on the weekend. That's at $50 million worldwide. Below that, another holiday comedy, A Bad Mom's Christmas, $12 million on the weekend, $78 million worldwide. So that's going to be fine when all is said and done. Here's something that really annoyed me. It's The Star. This is an animated film with lots of celebs doing voices, like Oprah Winfrey's even in it. And it's about the nativity, the birth of Jesus, told from the perspective of the animals. Okay, you know, politely, if poorly reviewed, it cost $20 million to make it. It made $10 million on its opening weekend in one territory, North America. This film, which you didn't take your kids to see, I take it, is rated PG. PG, The Star, the story of the nativity. And they felt the need to somehow eke out a PG rating because they were afraid nobody would go see it if it wasn't rated G.
That is correct.
I mean, are you kidding me?
They actually put stuff into these films to make them PG because
it's
a G rating.
It's the story of Jesus's birth.
I know. It's, they should, yeah.
Good God. I mean, that is just insane to me. I emailed an evangelical friend about that laughing. He said, well, you know, the animals do have to defecate. it's all he could think of. I don't think he'd seen the film yet. But anyway, that's annoying. Right below that is another family-friendly film. It's Paddington 2, $9 million on the weekend, $26 million worldwide, most of that in the UK. It's been snapped up for North American rights by Warner Brothers, and now we know what they paid for it, $32 million.
That's right, and it was purchased from the Weinstein Company.
But $32 million seems a lot. I guess they're going to have DVD rights as well.
Yes,
you know?
Correct.
And I mean, I would have to imagine, yeah, because then it makes sense. And number nine is The Golden Monk. It's a debut. It's a Chinese comedy fantasy about a monk who realizes he's the reincarnation of a fairy cast out of heaven, and he tries to track down his true love. It made $8 million on its opening weekend. We don't know what it cost. If you know what this movie costs, you know anything about it, let us know.
Yes, you can write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's D-I-R-T at showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can follow us on Twitter, where our handle is @showbizsandbox, or you can like us on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox.
I have the same question about a movie ranked far lower at number 14. It made about $3 million in its opening weekend. It's called A Better Tomorrow, which I assume is this remake that they've been talking about of the John Woo classic. But that was listed to come out in 2018. I assume that's this. I don't know why it's out now. But if you know anything about it, let us know about that as well. But jumping back up, we got a couple more films, a couple horror flicks still holding on. Happy Death Day is about to pass $100 million worldwide. And just behind that is Jigsaw, which is about to hit $90 million worldwide.
So then that's $190 million in gross for $15 million in budget. Let's double that, okay? Let's
combined,
say
combined.
Yeah, combined, yeah. That's $30 million total to make and market those two movies. And $190 million in box office. Do the math.
That's real money.
Yes.
Right below that is the German comedy Suck Me, Shakespeare. That made another $4 million. That's at $62 million worldwide. Coco, that's still playing strongly in Mexico. It's just about to hit $50 million, and it is the highest grossing animated film in Mexican history, in Mexican box office history. So yes, that film has done very, very well in Mexico. Lady Bird is doing terrifically here in North America. That's on the worldwide chart. Just from one territory, just from a couple hundred screens, it grossed $2.5 million on the weekend. It's at $4.7 million. It cost about $10 million to make, but this is a long haul film. Somebody asked me, hey, I don't have time to see Lady Bird this weekend. You think I'll be able to see it? And how long do you think it'll be in theaters? I'm like, through February or March or April, you know, depending on when they put it out on DVD. He's like, really? I go, yeah, no, this is an Oscar contender. It's going to have end of the year reviews. They're going to play this out. So he's like, oh, so I'll be able to see it in early December. I'm like, oh, good God. Absolutely. Of course you will.
Yeah,
so,
but I wouldn't. I mean, I've waited that long to see certain films. And what generally happens is the, you know, December kind of ramps up in December and then kind of contracts a little bit, and then the Golden Globes happen and it kind of ramps up again.
Or they put it out on DVD, Blu-ray in time for the Oscars. It just depends how it plays out.
Right.
But this film, I think, is going to have a lot of legs and run for a long time. It's been word of mouth. I hope they don't open it wide too quickly. I'm sure they will have a big burst come perhaps the end of the year awards, or they'll wait for the Oscar nominations. You know, just keep building it slowly. Let packed houses see the film, because they'll enjoy it a lot more than if you suddenly jump to 3,000 screens. You know, it's going to make for a better audience experience. So you don't want to open up too widely too quickly. Patriots Day opened up in another territory. That's the Mark Wahlberg drama we were talking about before the show began. $2 million on the weekend. That's at $52 million worldwide. It's unlikely that's going to end up a success story. But, you know, again, it's one of those. It costs about $45 million to make. It's made $52 million. It's not a good story to be had. It's probably, you know, it will eke out some money, I'm sure, when all is said and done, but certainly not a big hit. Geostorm, that's at $200 million worldwide. And here's another new film. This will be the last one we talk. Well, we got one below that. I beg your pardon. This film is called Room Number 7. It's a South Korean comedy about a body found in a room of a DVD rental store. Hilarious. I guess it's some sort of Weekend at Bernie's type thing. Apparently they find a body, and instead of somehow calling the police, they end up trying to rent out or sell the room that it's contained in so they don't have to deal with it anymore. That's the plot as far as I could figure. And then we've got another Met Opera event. It's Met Opera, The Exterminating Angel. Great reviews for this opera. And now it's played worldwide on cinema screens. Making $1.4 million on the weekend. I'm really sorry I wasn't able to see that opera yet.
Would you normally have seen this? I mean, or did you not want to buy a ticket to that particular opera? Because as you know, Michael, if there's anybody that knows, opera is not cheap. Did you not want to buy a ticket, or what's the deal?
Well, our friend Stephen Garrett has a connection. He goes to a lot of opera and takes me as his guest. And unfortunately, someone else had dibs on The Exterminating Angel. And I am trying to save my pennies because, as people might know, you and I are thinking of maybe buying a piece of Fox. We might just want to buy ourselves a film and TV studio. Why not? Everybody else is.
Yeah, you know, we heard that Disney was kind of poking around 20th Century Fox, or 21st Century Fox is what they were poking around, to maybe buy 20th Century Fox. Talk about confusing. And we thought, hey, well, if it's for sale, how much money do you have, Michael? Because I think I have like a few dollars in my wallet here. And then, you know, all of a sudden Comcast comes along, and then so does Sony, and then so does Verizon. Apparently everybody wants a piece of 21st Century Fox.
Yes. And does any of this make sense? Are they just buying the library? Or, I mean, I guess Verizon is different. Verizon would be coming into a new area where Comcast already owns Universal, right?
Correct. And so I think if Comcast purchased 20th Century Fox, I think you really got to start wondering here about, you know, how big is too big? I mean,
well, and Disney and Sony.
Yes, although Comcast owns its own distribution pipeline. Okay. Mm-hmm. Verizon, okay, it would be the same thing as Comcast taking over NBC Universal. It would be Verizon taking over 20th Century Fox, and then not all of it, okay?
Just a portion. It's more horizontal integration than vertical, or?
No. It's vertical integration. It's more vertical integration than horizontal integration. The question is, you're Comcast is, and Comcast NBC Universal is already vertical. The question that you're having now is, it's growing horizontally if they purchase 20th Century Fox. So it would be coming, it's already an 800-pound gorilla. It would become a 1,200 to 1,600-pound gorilla.
It's just insane. And the stock is soaring. And I don't know, does this make sense for 21st Century Fox to be selling off these crown jewels? I don't quite get it. They want to be slimmer. They don't want to deal with it. They just want to focus on news and sports. I guess that's their reckoning. That's their determination. Clearly, they've got a lot of buyers. So someone's going to buy it, right? It's in play. Everybody wants a piece of it. They're going to drive up the price. Somebody's going to make this deal.
Well, a couple of things. Mm-hmm. You can definitely tell that Fox was the person, the company that let this leak. Okay. And there was some question as well, how did CNBC find this out? Fox, you know, 21st Century Fox kind of said, hey, did you know Disney's been talking to us about purchasing 20th Century Fox? Because that actually started this whole bidding war. Okay, so that's number one. Number two, you have the Murdochs, which control, you know, it's family controlled, and they value that control a lot. Okay, they do not want to have anybody kind of come in and take control. And unfortunately, there's some stuff going on in Saudi Arabia where one of the princes who owns a huge stake in 21st Century Fox and was effectively letting the Murdochs do whatever they wanted. They said, you know, this particular prince said, hey, do what you want.
It's just not controlling stock, isn't it? Then they'd sell him stock that you wouldn't have control on the board or you wouldn't get seats.
Correct, but he's the largest shareholder. So if his stock fell into somebody else's hands, it could potentially be enough shares where the Murdochs would lose the majority share. You know, they wouldn't be majority shareholders. So
and he's under arrest.
And he's under arrest. And, you know, there's a whole political thing going on in Saudi Arabia. And so the Murdochs may be looking to take 21st Century Fox private. And they're going to need money to do that. To get that money, they need to sell some assets. That's what the thinking is behind some of these moves.
So if they're private, the person owning the majority stock won't still have the same control
because
it'll be a different company?
Correct. Exactly.
Yeah. Right. Well, one thing to think about when you look at this, when all these mergers and acquisitions, is how does that affect consumers? And people talk about self-dealing of studios when we've got all these lawsuits going on. One big reason is because these companies are so big, they can't help but be self-dealing themselves, can't they?
Well, correct. That's absolutely right. And I know we're moving on to, pick your lawsuit.
Supernatural.
In a way, if Fox was trying to start a bidding war and they wanted to take themselves private, well, they just, you know, made their stock go up. So I don't necessarily know how that works. But as you say, Michael, Fox has been in that whole lawsuit racket before where they got caught with self-dealing, specifically for The X-Files. David Duchovny sued 20th Century Fox saying, hey, Fox Television produced The X-Files and then sold it to its own, FX at a much lower rate than if it had been sold to, say, TBS over at Warner Brothers. And so you should have sold it for, let's say, $100 million and my residuals would have been X.
Right, right. These cases are many and they're getting worse.
Right. And so now, now you have it with Supernatural.
Right, right, right. Yeah, we don't need to go over the old one. We've got a brand new one to talk about. Supernatural has been on the air for 13 seasons, a massively successful drama on the CW, or if you prefer, a horrible flop.
Well, the Warner Brothers would prefer a horrible flop, or at least that you believe that it's a horrible flop, because that way they don't have to pay any residuals to anyone ever.
Yes. So this show, as people were pointing out, as you were talking about The X-Files before I cut you off, same thing here. By season five, they say, most shows charge a license fee that matches or exceeds the show's actual budget for that season. Warner Brothers was not getting that from the CW, which we should point out, they only own half of. Other people own another half of it, so they don't have total control over the CW. But, you know, that's going on. After eight seasons, they were claiming the show had grossed, I think, like $580 million or something like that, and that they had lost, still were in the red on like $24 million. Sort of the show, $23 million. The longer it runs, the more in the red you get. It's a crazy thing. But that's what they claimed. After 8 years on the air, this show had grossed over $500 million and was losing money.
And it's usually the opposite, in fact, because, you know, once you have a show that's been on that long, you kind of know people are going to watch it, and depending on ratings. And so one of the reasons that networks will drop a show is because it becomes too expensive to produce because of the licensing fees.
Exactly. So yeah, so here obviously everybody's happy. They kept the licensing fees low. It's been on to its 13 years, but as far as accounting is concerned, this show is a money loser. I don't know if that's still the case because we've had another 5 years since then, but in this court case, we're actually looking at statements from them referring to the show after season eight as being a money loser, which is of course absurd.
Well,
why are you still making it if you're losing? If you're 8 years in, you can't make money yet, you maybe should get in a different business.
True. And then you have Columbo.
that's right. Columbo. More suing, right?
Yes, it's the case of the missing accounting statement. And the victims this time, creators William Link and Richard Levinson.
That's right. They created the hit TV show Columbo, starring Peter Falk in the role of a lifetime for him. It ran for 7 seasons in its heyday on NBC, but then more and more specials and things kept going on for literally decades afterwards. Who's the suspect in this case, if they're the victims?
Well, should we say what the crime is first?
Sure.
Well, Link and Levinson say they received their first accounting statement 45 years after the show debuted.
Why were they not suing and speaking 40 years ago? I've never understood this.
Statute of limitations, anybody? The pair, by the way, say their contract called for them getting 10 to 20% of net profits. Yes, net, not gross. But they they suggest creating one of the most iconic and long-lasting characters in TV history. It might just be profitable, by the way. It probably could make a penny or two. And the studio finally sent a profit participation statement and a check for $2.3 million, which means after 45 years...
Don't bother us.
That's pretty much what that meant, actually. The raincoats that Columbo wore, they don't come cheap, okay?
So after 45 years, they said maybe, I guess the show grossed net profited $23 to $46 million, depending on how you measure their cut to 10 to 20%. So they're saying after decades, maybe they made $50 million. So here's your $2 million. Go away. Don't bother us anymore. And that would be Universal.
Well, and that might be true. Remember when that show was on. So...
In the sense of the accounting, the way they do, but it's not true that the show has not been profitable. Of course it's been profitable.
Oh, absolutely. It's been profitable.
Yeah, and it's not $50 million profitable. It's a hell of a lot more profitable than that.
Oh, Inspector, one more thing.
What's that?
George Miller, okay, the director of the Mad Max thing, the Mad Max films, he's due a $7 million bonus if the film came in under a certain budget. The last film, Mad Max Fury Road.
Yeah.
And the studio says, hey, George, you didn't come in under budget. Miller says, only because of your absurd requests and financial shenanigans that shouldn't count. I did my job. And the studio says, you can't sue us in Australia. And Miller says, yes, I can. Australian courts, they agree.
That's right. So where this case takes place matters a lot. It went, I think, up to the highest court of the land. And they said, no, we do have jurisdiction in this case. Miller claims his agreement was with Warner Brothers Australia, not with Warner Brothers Los Angeles or wherever they're based in America. And that's why they have jurisdiction over this. And that creates different issues in terms of accounting and stuff and what they have to show and agree with. And he says, hey, I delivered the film. You asked me to do things that were, that led to an over budget, but they weren't because of anything I did. I brought the film in under budget in the areas that were under my control. And you're playing games with how you're doing the accounting, and it's not good. Usually, people don't sue when a film is not a quote-unquote commercial success, and this movie certainly wasn't by the broadest understanding of the terms. It costs a lot to make. It made a good amount of money worldwide, tons of Oscar attention. We feel like it's a valuable property for them long-term, but it's not like it grossed a ton of obvious big bucks. And yet he says, hey, I want my bonus. $7 million is still a lot of money to me.
Well, and because part of the decision-making process and should I do this film or not is, well, okay, we're not paying you your rate, but just do it. Mm. If you come in under budget, then you'll get the bonus and bring you up to the rate that you would normally make. Well, okay, he agrees
to that lower initial price or lower cut of the profits, and then you screw him out of that bonus.
Right, correct.
Yeah, exactly. So, that's interesting. So a lot of suing going on. Eventually, maybe some of them will actually go to court and we'll see some facts on the ground rather than just settle out of court so that no precedent is set.
And this is just on the original films. OK, these are just, Columbo's original run on what was it, NBC?
I don't know. Wouldn't it include syndication and all that? Why not?
Oh, true. But I mean,
yeah, that's part of the show's profitability. Supernatural is hugely successful in syndication.
Right, but they haven't remade it yet.
Oh, that's right. It's time for this week in reboots.
That's right. Yeah, George Clooney, he's going to direct a remake of Catch-22 for TV, a 6-episode miniseries. There's no network, no channel, no streamer attached.
But there will be.
Yes.
He's also going to star. It's apparently his favorite book. The film version is not good. I'm not even a big fan of the book. It seems a very hard one to turn into a property, but
I agree.
Maybe they've cracked the nut.
Yeah, I agree with that. And then CBS is developing a series based on the film comedy Stripes, which I felt like they did that already, but correct me if I'm wrong. Yeah, I think they, I don't know. Did they?
They did a Private Benjamin.
Oh,
I
that's
know
what
there
I'm
was
thinking
a Private
of.
Benjamin TV
yeah,
series.
That's what I'm thinking of.
I think Stripes felt more like it was just all about Bill Murray. So I don't think it makes as much natural sense the way Private Benjamin has a strong hook to it. I don't really see what the deal is with, you know, just dudes in the military, I guess.
Yeah.
In peacetime is sort of the appeal, though there is no peacetime anymore. So it's not as funny. But
I agree.
I guess they're going to be based in America and have no threat of being deployed overseas.
And then I guess Showtime, they're reviving the L Word.
Yes, we talked about that before, and now they have a showrunner, so that's closer to happening. And we had talked about the Lord of the Rings series, and you were saying you hope they did a different story, not just remake what we've seen in the movies. And that's exactly what they're doing. It's going to be a prequel set before the Fellowship of the Rings. So it is telling a story in Middle Earth, but not the same Gandalf and Frodo that we've heard before. So that's interesting. The possibilities are endless, frankly. I don't know what they have in mind. And they do have the rights to another series set in the Lord of the Rings world. Obviously, you could have a story of just the Rangers and Aragorn and his people keeping the Shire safe. Or not the Shire, all of the West safe from the bad guys. You could just do anything. So who knows what they'll be plucking out of the air. But I'm very excited about this last story. It's a remake of Cool Runnings.
What? This was the film inspired by the Jamaican bobsled team, right?
That's right. There's a sequel in the works now that the Nigerian women's bobsled team has just qualified for the 2018 Winter Olympics. They're the first Nigerians to qualify for any Winter Olympics.
Okay. There might be a good reason for that. There's no snow in Nigeria.
Hence the humorous and yet heartwarming story of triumph over adversity and lack of snow.
Now,
it's actually not true. There is no film being made, but I just thought the Nigerian women's bobsled team is coming. Surely someone will make a remake of Cool Runnings doing it with women this time. Come on, people, get on the ball.
By the way, if you do that, we expect a cut.
Absolutely.
Now, going back to the Lord of the Rings for a second, I thought there was a prequel to that trilogy. It was called The Hobbit.
Well, yes, it won't be part of that. The Hobbit either. It's just set before that stuff happened. So, yeah, it could be set, you know, I don't think they're going to go back and do the Silmarillion. It's going to be around the era, I think, of The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings. I'm sure there'll be stuff in the Shire. But, you know, frankly, there's just no end to what they might choose to do. Maybe it'll be some story hinted at in the books that they'll draw out and make bigger, or who knows?
Well, I know Amazon picking it up was kind of big news, at least for a streamer to pick up that property.
Absolutely. That was the one of the hottest properties imaginable, a hugely profitable name brand, a lot of attention and excitement for it. So it's definitely a big deal.
Well, you know, if you're going to talk about big deals, it must be time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, the era of hundreds and hundreds of cable channels may be coming to an end, thank God. Don't get us wrong. With streaming services, you'll find more outlets than ever offering TV shows. But the ability of ESPN to demand cable companies carry ESPN 7 and ESPN 9 and ESPN U, and yeah, I mean, it just goes on forever. And all of those other channels, that is over. Which explains why NBC's poorly conceived channel, Chiller, is dead and done. The vaguely horror and thriller-themed channel had no real identity or purpose, or I didn't even know it was around, any more than NBC's silly streaming comedy service called CISO. Its death follows in the wake of other collapsed channels with minimal viewership, including the Esquire channel and the mystery channel dubbed Clue.
Formerly known as Sleuth.
Yeah, I've got to tell you, some of these channels, I knew Esquire existed, but some of these channels I don't even know exist. Big deal or big whoop.
It's a big deal because it's a change in the business. It's impactful. It is going to make a difference. You know, when cable was the only game in town, you could force them to carry your stupid channel that nobody really wanted or cared about. And then people bitch, why am I paying for this channel? Well, you're not really, because nobody cares that it's there and nobody's watching it. But that ain't going to happen anymore. You want a skinny bundle? Guess what? You may be getting it on cable in general.
Yes.
Because there's a lot of channels with like 40,000, 30,000, 50,000 viewers that don't belong to be in existence, but are only there because they're forced to be carried. And it doesn't really cost a lot to carry them. It's just, you know, expanding the thing. But, you know, they're going to shut it down because there's no point to them.
I mean, think about it. Even if you're making like 10 cents per subscriber per month, okay, and you're talking $60, $70 million, start doing the math on that. And all the channel is doing is showing reruns, okay?
Yeah.
Start doing the math on that.
Is the math good or bad?
Well, you're $7, $8, $9, $10 million a month. I mean, that's
right.
And all you're showing is reruns of properties.
Of stuff you already own,
yeah,
perhaps?
I mean, it's, yeah, it's, and the operating costs are negligible.
Yeah, but if it was a good business, they wouldn't be shutting it down.
True, although I guess that's when you go from 10 cents to one penny, then it becomes, you know, you're financially upside down because there are some operating costs to do that.
Yeah.
Speaking of operating costs, Rupert Murdoch has a media empire and the supremely wealthy far-right Koch brothers are feeling a little jealous. They've tossed in $500 million, or as I like to call it, chicken feed. And they've done that. They've tossed it into the Meredith Publishing Group, which has been dancing around a purchase of Time Inc. for years. First, Meredith said they wanted to buy a lot of Time Inc. titles, but not, oddly, Time, Fortune, Money, and Sports Illustrated. Then they couldn't come up with the money. Then Time Inc. said they didn't want to sell. Now they want to sell. Meredith wants to buy. And the Koch brothers are writing the check. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal, right? Publishing, print publishing is a fading era. Meredith owns evergreens like Family Circle and Better Homes and Gardens, which I'm assuming does not have a really strong presence online. Maybe I'm wrong about that. Time used to be the most valuable property in Time Inc., but now it's people. Time Inc., Time Magazine probably doesn't even make sense anymore. You think, why don't they want to buy it? Because nobody waits to read their weekly news magazine anymore. But people is still a valuable property. The big question is, how much influence will the Koch brothers want to have, if any, on the whole thing?
Well, isn't that always the rub?
Yeah.
One fallout from the Harvey Weinstein scandal? Director Quentin Tarantino's new project was up for grabs. Based on the Charles Manson killing spree of 1969, the film comes with a pricey budget of $100 million, or as DC and Marvel like to say, a low-budget film. And of course, there's the demand from Tarantino for Final Cut and First Dollar Gross. He got it from Sony, who probably hopes the one picture deal will lead to a long-term relationship with a director proven to have commercial instincts and Oscar-worthy films. Big deal or big whoop?
Big deal for Sony, and happily, they now know there's one less person who might sue for profit participation. Charles Manson.
That's true.
He's dead.
He died this morning. Or,
yes,
or late yesterday, I should say.
Well, dead. I thought, wow, that's a lot of money to pay for a Tarantino film. And I thought, gee, that seems, you know, like he's getting his biggest budget ever practically. Is that a good idea? Is he squeezing them for this, you know, project because he has the opportunity, you know, because of the circumstances? But when you look back on it, actually, Django Unchained, that had a $100 million budget, and that grossed $450 million worldwide. Inglourious Basterds had a $70 million budget, and that grossed $315 million worldwide. Whereas his last movie, The Hateful Eight, didn't do great worldwide. That had an even lower budget of $55 million. I think Tarantino knows when he's got needs the money for the movie he wants to make and what sort of reach it'll have. And he seems a pretty responsible filmmaker in terms of not asking for a big budget, or at least delivering when he does. So I think, you know, my instinct was, wow, that's too much money. But now I think, no, you know what? He's a good bet.
NFL football is all over the TV dial, just not on any of those channels that just got axed. There were so many matchups on so many days that it's no surprise viewership trended down 8% last season, and that was before the pregame controversy of players protesting racial injustice and police brutality during the national anthem. Ratings are fine this season, blipping up and down, but still dominating viewership. More importantly, advertisers are paying more than ever to buy a spot on football. NBC's Sunday Night Football jumped from an average of $650,000 for a 30-second spot to $728,000. NBC's Thursday spots are up, as are ESPN's Monday spots. Only the CBS Thursday night games are down a tad. And Sunday afternoon is bigger than ever. On Fox, they are averaging $760,000 for a spot. So keep that in mind the next time someone says football is a bust in the ratings.
Trump.
Yeah. Viewership is pretty, and advertisers are paying more than ever to reach them. And of course, European football or football around the world, that's always a ratings. You know, that's always something to...
Are you just boasting that they have the same name?
Yeah, pretty much, yeah.
Big deal or big whoop? I would say it's a big deal. Football is still strong. I think they have overextended themselves. Thursday night is a mistake. I think they should pull back on it. It's not a good idea. Even if they're making money on it, it just dilutes the game too much. But Sunday Night Football, the latest ratings were strong, very good. It's on an uptick. So, you know, it's still the number one TV show in the country, Sunday Night Football. So, yes, it's at a mature audience. It's at a career peak in terms of reach. There's nowhere to go but down. but they're still making a lot of money.
Wondering what we might learn if cable companies use their set-top boxes to share viewing habits? Well, Nielsen keeps trying to make deals with services, though their demand for exclusivity is hurting them. And Comcast just gave us a sneak peek by sharing the top TV shows their customers watched on demand this fall. Right at number one, the breakout hit on ABC, The Good Doctor. They seem to be tracking on-demand viewing rather than DVR, and they don't clarify whether they're ranking them by pure numbers or a percentage of their original broadcast audience or what. But anyway, it's interesting. Serialized dramas like American Horror Stories and the PBS documentary The Vietnam War are on the list, which says it covers viewing from, say, mid-season, mid-September through Halloween, were the numbers. Missing from the list, the number one network CBS, which has none of their hit dramas and just The Big Bang Theory among comedies. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop. I mean, the story was so confusing and so vague about what they're actually showing us, it was kind of useless, but it makes you want to know the real numbers. So it's frustrating, to say the least.
If you thought the new Willy Wonka musical was going to have a long run on Broadway, well, that was pure imagination. Michael warned us that a show that did so poorly in London wasn't going to magically become good when it came to Broadway. Despite some retooling, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory was a creative bust and closes January 18th, less than 9 months after opening. But is it a commercial disaster? The show certainly lost money, but now it's going to tour the US, the UK, Australia, and down the road, there will be high school and community theater productions. Heck, if the Addams Family can eventually turn a profit, why not this? Big deal or big whoop?
I guess it's a big whoop. A 9-month run brands it as a Broadway show. I think enough that it's okay for its future commercial prospects. Too bad they didn't make a good one, but they may turn out a hit when all is said and done.
The book industry is losing another string of stores. Bookworld is a chain in the Midwest. I had no idea about it. It has 45 stores in mid-size and smaller communities. You can find them in downtown areas and shopping malls. Wait, there are still shopping malls? Or rather, you could, because the chain announced it was going out of business. Blame e-commerce for the demise of 20 stores in Wisconsin, 8 in Illinois, 7 in Michigan, and so on. The company's head says they weathered the transition to ebooks, but the collapse of retail meant anchor stores at malls were doing poorly or closing, and downtowns got less foot traffic, and the loss of casual customers meant Bookworld just couldn't survive. They say some of their locations are still profitable and hope someone in those communities will step up. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal. I mean, it's sad, stores that are succeeding are closing. Because other ones in the chain aren't working. You're seeing that with a lot of these retail chains. Sometimes it's just the debt burden that they've had when private investors take over them that cripples them, even though they're still making money. Toys R Us was doing okay, and it's gone bankrupt. So it's really bad when even you can survive retail-wise, but your debt burden or the industry as a whole drags you down. But yeah, every time you lose some stores, that is not good for the book industry, because the whole idea that independents are coming back, that's absurd in the context of things. We're not anywhere near where we were 10 years ago, and we never are going to be again.
15 Democratic senators are looking to slow down the Sinclair Tribune merger. Not to mention broad new rules being promoted by FCC Chairman Ajit Pai. When the two companies merge, they'll control more than 200 stations and reach 72% of the entire United States.
What could possibly go wrong?
Everything. Other rules will allow companies to own two stations in the same market, as well as cross-ownership in TV and newspapers, creating a supermajority in a market across all media, where they could own two TV stations and radio stations and a local newspaper. The senators want a full review, claiming Pai is compromised by a quid pro quo between him, the Trump administration, and Sinclair. The broadcast industry thinks the changes are awesome and defends the FCC's actions as benefiting the industry. The senators say, what about the public? Pai's response was, what did you think I was going to do? Well, not exactly, but that's the gist of it. Indeed, the FCC voted to relax the media ownership rules in a partisan 3-2 vote that will be challenged in court, no doubt. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a very big deal. They're not going to be able to slow it down. Maybe they'll have more success in court. One of the quirky little changes is the UHF discount.
I know.
This is a joke where, like, stations that are classified as UHF, They said, well, okay, your signal is weaker, and therefore we'll consider your control of the market half what it normally would be considered. It gets a little dorky, but basically when you're talking about how much of a market they control or how much of the country they control, doing that means, all right, you've sort of, you may own a bunch of UHF stations, but we're going to pretend they don't have the same reach as the other stations. But of course, now that we're digital, the idea that they have a weaker signal is a joke that doesn't come into play anymore. And this merger would not happen if that rule alone was still in place. If you still measured stations the way they should be measured, that alone would have blocked this merger. But, you know, you get rid of these quirky little rules that don't seem to make, you know, who cares? Well, this is what happens.
Well, and for those that don't know, and those that might be outside the United States, there's a rule in place where if you own one TV station within a market, say Los Angeles, New York, Washington, D.C., Boston, etc., you can't own a second TV station because then, of course, you would control all the programming on both those stations and you could influence people by saying, you know, I don't know, please vote for Donald Trump or please vote for, you know, such and such a person. And of course, same thing with radio and same thing with newspapers. And
yeah, you don't want all your news coming from one source.
Correct. And Sinclair has been faulted for, I don't know, eons, it seems like, for doing just that, where they basically report things that are not true at all. They just are plain not true, and they then spread them from station to station. Well, if all of a sudden Sinclair owned not one, but two stations in every highly populated market, it would be a big problem.
Well, yeah, they deal in propaganda, but that's not even the point. You could have two perfectly respectable news organizations. You still wouldn't want one of them to own most of a city. Most of the media, you want competing organizations because that's healthier and better for the public space. It doesn't, you don't have to have one of them be actually corrupt and evil to make this case. It's not a question of their poor journalism, which is in fact very poor. It's the fact that you just don't want any one company to dominate the media in a city. It's just not healthy.
Well, and if you want to learn a little bit more about the Sinclair and Tribune merger, I would suggest looking up, and maybe I'll place a link to it in the show notes. John Oliver covered this on Last Week Tonight a couple of weeks ago or a couple of months ago, and it was very insightful.
Cool.
But let's stick with the FCC for a second because they have been quite busy. They approved standards for new technology that will improve picture quality on TVs, tablets, and phones. It also raises privacy concerns. In another partisan vote of 3-2, they set standards for ATSC 3.0. This allows geolocation of TV signals, interactive programming, ultra-high-def picture quality, and offers the ability to give weather alerts targeted street by street and even turn on the receiver in an emergency. The signal is not backwards compatible and will allow advertisers potentially to know who is watching where. South Korea adopted the standard in 2016. Big deal or big whoop?
I have no idea. Sperling,
I'm going to go with big whoop. I'm going to go with big whoop because if South Korea is doing it, this is becoming a worldwide standard. So you may as well just switch over to it because all the electronics and the devices will actually be capable of, you know, handling it. So you may as well just adopt it.
Is this the standard? We've been talking about the next generation of picture quality, which we've been calling ultra high def, but it isn't an actual standard, right? Is this that standard?
I do not know. I you know, when it comes to this, I...
You don't know? I thought you would know.
You know,
I'm so sorry.
ATSC 3.0, it's, you know, it's considered next gen TV. I would need to get into it. It's going to support 4K. It's going to support ultra high def. It's going to support high dynamic range and high frame rate and a wide color gamut. So if it's supporting all of that, then yes, this is that next standard.
But we don't have a standard for ultra high def yet, right?
Correct. However, ATSC will work into it.
How can it if there's no thing to work into? I mean, if there's no, I'm confused. So maybe you should learn more and come back and educate us. But if this is basically, oh, well, what can you do? It's going to be the worldwide standard. We need to adopt it. Why was it a partisan vote of 3-2?
I don't know.
Is it because of the privacy concerns?
Yes, I have a feeling that's what it is.
And are those overblown or silly? I mean, everybody knows where you are right now thanks to your phone. Why are you worried about your TV signal? You know, what's the counter argument?
Well, the concern is really targeting ads to a specific person. So they'll know what you're watching, when you're watching. And it's the same concern that you would have if, like, you know, the government knew every book you checked out of a library, right?
And they do. Well, they don't there, but yeah, that's about the only place you're safe.
Right.
But yeah, no, it's annoying. And they don't do a very good job of it, because if you go online and you buy a mattress, for some reason, for the next 6 months, you see mattress ads and it gets so tiresome. And I wish it would end. And so they don't do a great job of that yet, where you feel like, oh, that's, I was looking for that. Instead, it's just like, yeah. I looked at that once. Leave me alone. That's how I feel those things work right now. So if you bring that to the TV, that sounds even more annoying.
Correct. But let's move on to Amazon, because they are dropping plans to offer a skinny bundle. The online giant does offer channels, an a la carte service that networks are wary of. They wanted to move into bundling a package of network and cable shows, but were unable to make the deals necessary. Amazon expected a discount because of their massive consumer base. The various networks said, hey, no, not at all. And looking at the numbers, Amazon decided it just didn't make sense right now to continue pursuing this project. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big whoop, because I think there's a lot of other companies creating the skinny bundle. So it's not like we're down to just one or two. So things like competition is healthy. They're not in the game. Well, okay.
Netflix is the biggest streaming service worldwide. But for how long? Netflix claims 109 million subscribers worldwide. Far back, but gaining, is China's Tencent. The streaming service says it has now hit 43 million paid subscribers and says it's the biggest platform in China. Not so, says, oh my goodness, you're not going to make me pronounce this, are you? Is it
I don't have no idea.
It's IQIYEI, which I'm sure is pronounced some way. But it's
IQIYEI.
It's a Chinese competitor which claims 60 million subscribers, but that may be comparing apples to oranges in terms of the cost and how they count their users. So who knows? We do know that Netflix isn't the only game in town, at least in Asia. And Tencent claims big jumps in revenue to almost $10 billion and net profits of $2.5 billion. That's a lot. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big market. I think that's what we know. That's what we could say, right? China's a big market. So yeah, Tencent is there. There are other competition for them. How are they going to grow outside of China? That'll be an important thing to see and keep an eye on. But yeah, they're also going to be a buyer. Like, you look at Amazon, we were just talking about them. They snagged the U.S. Open tennis rights for the U.K. They snagged AMC Studios, the home of Mad Men and Breaking Bad and The Walking Dead. They've gotten exclusive rights to all their product in various territories around the world. So there's a lot of big buyers out there with big pockets that need content. And so Tencent, if they're another one, that's good news for Hollywood.
Streaming isn't the future. It's the present. In a report by Nielsen, the audience measurement company says almost 60% of U.S. homes have at least one device that can stream content to their TV. And many have more than one. 25%, by the way, to be more exact. Common devices include Apple TV, Roku, Google Chromecast, Amazon Fire, gaming consoles like PlayStations, and of course, smart TVs. Like the penetration of 3D-enabled TVs, having the ability doesn't mean people are actually taking advantage of it. But with so many ways to stream, it's clear this option is gaining momentum. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big deal. I feel like people are really streaming now. It's so easy. Even I can do it, that sort of thing. You know, my friend has a Roku, and there you go. There's Amazon. There's YouTube. You know, it's easy. There's Netflix. It feels like just going to a channel. It's slightly more cumbersome than just turning on the guide and going to a TV channel. You got to click here and click, and then, okay, click on the app. But it's gotten pretty damn easy, hasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, yesterday, because of the...
Why did I curse? I just gave us a PG. No! That's just like the star. I didn't mean to curse there. Oh, I feel terrible. Sorry, kids.
Well, yesterday I
was... Son of a... I cursed again. Sorry.
Yesterday I was cleaning up ahead of the renovations here, and there were all these DVDs. And ooh, my kids were like, well, what are we going to, you know, can we keep some of these? And I was like, do we really need to? The last time I actually watched a DVD, I can't even remember the last time I put a DVD in a DVD player or a Blu-ray for that matter.
Well, I do it all the time.
But yeah,
I get so many of them. And I have friends who, of course, get the Oscar campaign. They just got Out. I'm looking forward to checking that out.
Yeah, true. That's true. Now, best-selling and acclaimed author Donna Tartt fired her agent, the legendary Binky Urban. What a great name. Coming after Urban landed her a $3 million contract for the screen rights to The Goldfinch. This seems surprising, especially since Urban has repped her since at least 1992. Or perhaps not so much. Tartt wanted the chance to write the screenplay, but didn't get it. She also wanted a producing credit, though it's unclear if this means she wanted and I get an Oscar producing credit, which is hard, or just a plain old producing credit, which is a little bit easier. But she got neither, which is odd. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, this is a story from Page Six, so maybe it's a big whoop. Who knows what the truth of it is? But if this is what she wanted, it is a bizarre that she didn't get it. You know, who wasn't listening to who here? I don't know what happened, but she's left her after all 25 plus years. So that's a little upsetting. So something clearly went on, and it's not the price tag, I don't think, that she got for the book and the screenplay rights. I think it's, you know, these sound like reasonable complaints. If in fact she wanted the chance to write the, you know, they usually just toss you $100,000 or whatever and you do your thing and they can ignore it or use it. You know, it's a sort of, you know, standard issue to get a shot at writing the screenplay if you want to do that. Doesn't mean they have to use it, you know.
Yeah, and you know, certainly that's often what happens. It's they'll, you know.
Yeah, sure, knock yourself out, kid, and they look at it and go, yeah, whatever, and they move on, or they say, oh, it's actually good, and they build on it, or who knows. But yeah, it's such a common thing. It's bizarre that, you know, so I don't know whether that means I should question Page Six's comment, which is a good thing to do, or whether I say, well, Binky, what'd you do here? What went wrong? It's clearly, perhaps it's just the straw, you know. Perhaps there were other problems over the last few years, but who knows? She's only had like three books, so how much trouble could she be?
Well, now, Page Six, we should point out to listeners overseas, is the New York Post kind of gossip column, right?
It's so there's nobody quoted talking about it. It's just what they claim is going on. So, you know, there's sometimes news in there, and it was just so interesting and specific. I thought, well, that's odd. It's odd that Binky wouldn't get it, but she's left her, so there's got to be some reason, and nobody knows what it is, and it seems like a strange one, but there you go.
Now, speaking of media ownership, don't the Murdochs own the Post?
They certainly do.
The New York Post, yeah. And they own Fox, of course, both in the same market there.
Yes, they do.
Okay, well, that brings us to Inside Baseball. Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And, oh, brother, you know, I want to say, can we, like, pick a few and just highlight some of them instead of all of them, because
there's this exhaustion for dealing with this endemic problem that children and women and men have dealt with since time immemorial. You know, it's like, is it easier to avoid hiring women than change the culture? Yes. Is that going to happen? No. Is rolling back the modest gains for women in front of and behind the cameras acceptable? No. Is it going to happen? Maybe. If we're not strong enough. But I keep going back to the child actors and hearing Molly Ringwald and Ellen Page and Corey Feldman and Alex Winter and Adam Rapp, Anthony Rapp, and all the other people talking about what happened to them as kids. And you just, I mean, I wish people, instead of rolling their eyes and being exhausted by it and thinking, oh God, or so angry and ready to say, well, we're going too far. I wish more people were angry about what's been happening and wanting to do something substantial to change it, because none of that's happening. What we're finding out is that women and men are coming together. Like when you've got 10 or 20 or 30 people speaking out, people go, oh yeah, I guess something's going on here. That seems to be the new trend. You know, if you get taken advantage of, you're humiliated and embarrassed. But if you speak up, you're going to find out other people have been too. And working together, you can change something about an individual. But absolutely nothing has changed in the business. Nothing.
Well,
nothing.
Let's go through some of these. I know that we've talked about some of these people, you know, like, for instance, Louis C.K. And Kevin Spacey, which, you know,
That was a bad one, though. Kevin Spacey, the old Vic, did an investigation and they reported on it and found complaints, 20 people and counting with complaints or witnessing inappropriate behavior or misconduct. But what they did was they blamed the cult of personality and the unique fact that Kevin Spacey was a world famous actor and Oscar winning movie star for why no one spoke out.
Okay.
And that's BS. That is complete joke. You're telling me Matthew Warchus, however you say his name, world famous Tony and Olivier winning artist. He's the current artistic director of the Old Vic. I know nothing about him. I assume he's a noble and fine man. And he had a project there and he said, I knew nothing. Of course, when you're a predator, you don't let people who are in power see you do stuff. You know, you're polite and friendly to them. But he said, I had no idea. It's not fair to say everybody knew because I didn't know and everything seemed fine when I was there. But now he's the artistic director of the Old Vic. You're telling me some new young person there is going to feel safe and strong and saying what you did was, I mean, he's all powerful there. The idea that, oh, it's Kevin Spacey, that's the only reason this happened. No. blaming the cult of personality. It's like whoever's in charge is powerful, even if we've never heard of them. You know, if you're in charge, people are not going to be ready to speak out against you. It's really hard to make a space safe for people to challenge their boss or their coworker, and certainly the head of the whole thing. So blaming the cult of personality, well, he's an Oscar-winning director, it's the only reason this crazy thing happened. No, that's not true, and they're wrong to blame it on that.
Well, where do you want to start? You want to start with Jeffrey Tambor?
Jeffrey Tambor. We went from a week from one person saying, I'm a transgender person, he mistreated me on set, to a second person coming forward, to the show discussing the idea of writing him out of the show, to Tambor himself angrily and bridge burningly quitting the show abruptly.
Yeah, him saying basically, hey, these are, you know, specious and false, and you know what? The show has become so, the space
I'm
has
sick
become,
of the politicized atmosphere on the set.
Yeah, that's it. You know, if you're not going to back me up on this, I'm gone. And so he said, you don't have to worry about writing me out of the show. I'm gone. So figure out your show.
His publicist and his manager should not have let him do that. There's nothing to be gained by what he did. You know, if he's guilty, obviously, you know, there's nothing to be gained, period. But, you know, you make your usual, I'm going to get counseling. If he's not guilty, thumbing his nose and treating them so angrily, you know, you can say if he's innocent, he feels betrayed that they didn't give him the benefit of the doubt. But nothing had happened yet, you know, necessarily. Actors spoke up and they said, we're going to investigate it. That's what had happened. And so to angrily quit the show the way he did just seems really, you know, it's the high peak point of his career, and it's really ending in an ugly way. But yet, you know, whether you're called out or just, you know, it's, I don't know how to say this. It's just it's a big, ugly mess, but you don't gain anything by doing what he did. That's for sure. No matter what the facts are.
Well, let's try and go through some of these.
Okay.
Quickly. So we got Louis C.K.'s manager apologizing. Okay.
Yeah, he says he shouldn't have dealt with the stuff the way he did. And we've got Brett Ratner and Russell Simmons teaming up to sexually harass and assault women. That's according to the LA Times.
Right. And they have several, you know, different witnesses there. Tom Sizemore was removed from a set in 2003 for molesting an 11-year-old girl. And many on the set confirmed this was occurring. The parents chose not to sue at the time. And he later returned to finish filming.
Yeah, it was at like the director's house or something, just to do some pickups or whatever. The woman's now 26. She's considering a lawsuit against Sizemore and her parents. And this is the guy who, of course, physically abused and harassed his then-girlfriend, Heidi Fleiss, been in jail, had all sorts of problems and issues, and has been making a comeback. You know, he was on Twin Peaks, the new revival. He's had, you know, sort of like, that was a long time ago when he beat up his girlfriend. We've moved on from there. Everybody deserves a second chance in society, but maybe they don't deserve a role in your film or TV show.
There was a DC editor who was fired for sexual harassment, Eddie Berganza.
Yeah, this is interesting. DC Comics, he was the top editor at DC. And in 2010, women working there as a group came forward and said, he is harassing and assaulting us. And they were ignored. Then in 2012, outside media reported on him doing something at a comic book convention. And then they felt compelled to do something. And they just demoted him, destroyed him. They kept him. They're like, well, all right. So their own workers came forward. Nothing. Media finally finds out something about something else that they can't ignore anymore. All they did was demote him to story it. They didn't get rid of him. They're like, well, all right, we'll have to take him away from it. It's like, you know, this is the mountain that people are climbing now. Today, everybody's acting like, oh, gosh, everybody's, you know, you're just taking everybody down so easily. You know what? People have been ignored for a long, long time. So something like that, you see, wow, your own employees come forward and have credible claims. They ignore it. And it's only when the outside media moves that you act and you do the minimal. You just, you know, demote them a little bit, but you still keep them there working on all your big projects. So, you know, he's been fired, but wow.
And then we have One Tree Hill, Mark Schwann, the showrunner. The crew has been saying that, you know, sexually harassing crew and cast members. Certainly well, he had, you know, abusive behavior as well.
Oh, absolutely. And he's now the showrunner of The Royals, except he's been suspended while they investigate his behavior on that show.
The world means wonder at the world. One of the seven impressive monuments created in the ancient world.
Is that Alexa?
Yeah, I don't know why she's talking. I don't know what's triggered her, but there you go. Here's the thing. One person came forward, and she did it on Facebook. One writer Audrey Washope, I'm sorry if I'm butchering your name, spoke up about an unnamed harasser. Everybody recognized who she was, and they came together as a group. 18 women, including like all the stars on the show, signed an open statement detailing his abusive behavior. They were joined by 8 men, and then the cast and crew of the Royals came forward. They signed, 25 of them, female cast and crew members on the Royals, complained about his repeated unwanted sexual harassment. So this is dozens of people coming forward to talk about this guy behaving like a pig. So one person began it, though, and they didn't even name him. But, you know, coming up and speaking out, and you feel humiliated and embarrassed, and you should have said something earlier, because this is a long time ago, One Tree Hill. The show's over with. But you speak up, other people may join you, and then you can make something change.
Well, actress Aurora Perrineau said the opportunity presented itself to writer Murray Miller on Girls, and so she's claiming sexual assault. This led to a whole bunch of Lena Dunham issues.
Oh, God. Well, this woman, this actress, filed a police report, so the LAPD is investigating. And that's what you always want someone to do if there's any chance of legal action, because it's great to have it in the courts rather than needing to have 10 or 20 people flock to your, you know, to your side to say it happened to them, too. You know what? Shouldn't happen once. He denies the charges, says she asked for money. The Girls showrunners Lena Dunham and Jenny Kohner immediately defended him and had a strong statement saying, you know what, it's important to listen to women, but 3% of all accusations are lies. I don't know where they got that number from, but we know this is one of them. She's a liar. And then immediately apologized for that and said, as feminists, we have to believe women. It's the first choice we make every single day. Everything she did was stupid. Everything she did was wrong. She should just shut up in the first place. But, you know, she called his accuser a liar. A young 17-year-old black woman, Lena Dunham, has a history of being charged with, you know, at least racial insensitivity in how she cast and did her show. But that's been a sort of an undercurrent for her behavior. Her description of feminism is moronic. Feminism does not mean you believe women. That's not feminism. Do you believe Sarah Palin? Do you believe Sarah Huckabee Sanders or Phyllis Schlafly? Being a feminist doesn't mean women are right. It means you believe that women deserve equal respect and rights under the law, just like men, and et cetera. But it doesn't mean believing women and disbelieving men. That is not the definition of feminism. It's pretty stupid of you to think it is. So everything she did was blew up in her face, and, you know.
She's never going to defend anybody ever again.
Well, you should defend. You're allowed to defend people. You should do it appropriately in the right way. And again, apologizing for defending your friend is stupid. You know, but she didn't just defend him and say, I know him. I've worked with him. I've never seen anything like this. But obviously, we're going to investigate. But everything I've seen from him, he's a great guy. That's, you know, okay. But what she did was she said, that woman's lying. She said she's a liar. That 17-year-old black woman is a liar.
Well,
she's
she
a
didn't
liar.
Say it that way, but
that's who she was IDing, though. That's why people are especially angry. They're like, you know what? You've got an insensitivity to black women, to people of color, and especially black women. And you're singling this woman out as a liar. How could you possibly know that? You may know him and think he's a great guy, but you don't know that she's a liar. But you can say he's a great guy. I like him. I respect him. And we're going to investigate it. But boy, I've never seen him behave inappropriately. That's fine. You want to do that. You shouldn't abandon your friends, you know. But that's not what she did. She said, this person is a liar.
Well, okay. We've got 5 pages here of, you know, a rap sheet, you know, as long
well,
as you,
well,
you
a can... lot, a lot of people, a lot of people are, you know, one person or they're still investigating. A New York Times top reporter, Glenn Thrush, is in trouble for stuff that he did when he was working at Politico. Ryan Seacrest has one accuser. And as you say, it's a hairstylist at E that says he harassed her a decade ago. He denies it. He is investigating it, and other people haven't come forward. So it's still a he said, she said. There you go. Lars von Trier's producer is being investigated. NBC News fired a booker. This musical artist, Gaslamp, is suing someone because they accused him of rape. Cine Family shut down. That's
actually,
kind of
no, the Gaslamp killer is basically suing his accuser saying, hey, you know what? No, that did not happen, and you can't keep saying that because... that did not happen. So,
right, and one of the people doing it was profiled in Playboy as the Andy Kaufman of the internet, a guy known for being a prankster. And this guy's name is Jack Wagner, and no, it's not the soap star and singer. So he's saying we had consensual sex. He's been dropped by his label. Concerts canceled. This is that potentially, you know, the fear of people who just want this all to go away. Well, people are going to accuse them, and lives will be destroyed, even though there's no truth to it. you know, this is one of those things where Gaslam Killer saying this is an example of that. We'll have to see as he sues them in court. But here's a sad real world repercussion. Cine family shut down.
Now, yeah, this is an L.A. repertory house, repertory cinema. And, you know, the founders and one or two people were, you know, there was some allegations of certainly a hostile work environment. Everybody kind of agreed on that. And there's rape allegations, and anonymous rape allegations, and harassment allegations, and the board, which includes some, big name producers and Hollywood personalities, they basically kind of reviewed the situation. They had a law firm review the situation, but they're a nonprofit. They were always struggling for money. So they said, we can only go so far here, and there's not much more we can do. And because we've kind of run through our budget and all the money we had, we have to shut down. So they're closing.
Yeah, that's a bummer. A casting agent who used to work on CSI has lost his current job. He was fired back in 2008 from CSI for pushing women to disrobe during private paid auditions, something we've talked about before. Don't pay to be in front of a casting agent because you think maybe you're going to get a chance to be on a show. Don't pay for auditions, which is what a lot of these workshops and stuffs are. So that's interesting. And it's part of the Acting Center scandal. Don't ever pay to audition or take lessons from casting agents in that way. It's very suspicious. Here's in the sex work industry, porn star Ron Jeremy faces allegations from a dozen women and counting on assault and rape. And it's very interesting because when you're a sex worker, whether you work in adult films or as a what we would call a prostitute or erotic dancer, essentially society thinks you don't have the right to say no. Anyone can rape you because what right do you have to say? You're being paid to have sex, so you have no right to say no to anyone for anything. So they never come forward. But now they're coming forward and saying, you know what? This guy has taken advantage of us and it's wrong. And even in the sex working business, there is consent and there is right and wrong. And they're going to speak up for it.
Speaking of speaking up, Marty Noxon speaks out for the accuser of Matthew Weiner.
Yeah, she says she didn't see anything particular about that case, but she was working with them. She saw the woman the next day, saw how shaken and disturbed she was and didn't know why, and how she remained so throughout the rest of their time on the show.
And the show being Mad Men, by the way.
Yeah, and she says Matthew Weiner has a toxic personality. She used extremely strong language about describing his behavior on the show as very toxic and very negative, and how she could completely understand how this could possibly be happening. So she is just standing by her and in solidarity and saying this guy is a bad person to work with.
You know, I know you're running down our list here, but what about certainly we talked about Adam Vinett last week, who was an agent over at William Morris Endeavor. And now we have CAA getting into the mix, Creative Artists Agency. There's a whole bunch of agencies that, you know, APA was in the mix at one point. CAA fired an agent.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, what we saw was Terry Crews complained to William Morris Endeavor about being treated poorly, like a piece of flesh, being grabbed by William Morris agent Adam Vinett. And they did nothing because he's not Will Smith. And they felt like Vinett was more valuable to them and earned more money to them because he repped Adam Sandler, Kevin James, Eddie Murphy, and so on. So Terry Crews was basically ignored. Then the Weinstein scandal broke and he was given a 1 month vacation. I mean, a suspension. Now he's speaking about it publicly on Good Morning America. And basically the pattern is agencies will protect their own employees and clients who harass and assault others. And they don't care if they're a problem because they're making money. And it will only change if there are lawsuits. If they're going to lose clients because they don't want to be associated with your agency because it's seen as a negative company, or if they're going to lose, you know, business because of it, if they have to pay a price, that's the only thing that will change. And yes, CAA is being sued over an agent's alleged assault and rape of a would-be client. This person came forward. They approached CAA's human resources department. They completely ignored them and blew them off. Now she's suing CAA and suddenly they fire agent Cameron Mitchell. I don't know how that works in terms of just cause and giving buttressing the woman's lawsuit against you, but that's what happened. She went to them, they ignored her, she files a lawsuit, now finally they fire the agent. Whether any of it's appropriate or true, we don't know because we're not privy to the details of the case or the facts. That's for a court of law to determine, but this is the only way things are going to change. People suing, people saying, I don't want to be your client because I don't like your agents and I don't like how that agent treated someone else, or agents not wanting to have clients who are doing this behavior. That's the only way the culture of Hollywood's going to change.
Yeah, well, it would also help if, and I know CAA does this, hey, how about sexual harassment education?
I'm sure everybody does it. Big deal. It's just something you do to cover your ass legally. Clearly, it's not very effective if they've got...
I was just going to say, you can cover... That might be the wrong expression, but you can do that, but at the end of the day, it's not working.
Yeah, people are sick of talking about this. Well, I'm sick of people being harassed, assaulted, and raped. Try to think of it that way.
Well, you know who's not sick anymore?
Yes.
Malcolm Young.
He's back in black, right? We're all in the mourning because Malcolm Young of AC/DC is dead at 64. He's had dementia for a few years. His family's been open about that. He's the guitarist and co-founder of the legendary heavy metal band AC/DC. His brother just died, George Young. He was the band's producer. He died in October at age 70. He was also a guitarist in Easy Beats, a pretty important group back in the day. So only Angus Young survives among the brothers. So it's the AC/DC coming to a close. That's one of those bands where they were sort of dismissed and mocked as just a big, dumb heavy metal band. But over the years, their stock has risen. As people go, you know what? Back in Black, these albums are pretty damn great.
Well, and then Della Reese died just today, actually, at age 86. And you might remember her from Touched by an Angel.
That's right. She's had a long career, though. Some great music. Her first charting single was from La Boheme, of all things. I just was reading this book called The Great Jazz and Pop Vocal Albums of All Time by Will Friedwald. You'd find it on Bookfilter. He's a terrific music historian, and he pinpoints like 50 to 70 albums that are among the best of all time. And one of Della's is on it. It's Della Della Cha-Cha-Cha. That's from the Latin Craze era. And that's a lot of fun. I just listened to it for the first time a few weeks ago. She was the first Black woman to have her own TV talk show. She was a real trailblazer.
And then who is this Sipora Schorschberger?
Very good, actually. Zipporah Yoxberger.
Oh, okay.
I only included her just to make you pronounce her name.
I had a feeling that was the case.
And she's an important person in New York. She's an arts patron. She died in 96. She was best known for founding and running for 33 years the Hebrew Arts School for Music and Dance, which is now known as the Kaufman Music Center. It's on the Upper West Side. She had a crazy life. She escaped from Nazi Germany, going to Palestine in 1939 at the age of 19 to study music. And her parents refused to leave the country. And, of course, they were killed in Auschwitz. So an amazing life. She did a lot. But when you see that name in the obituary, just go, that's a difficult name to pronounce.
Yes, indeed. But you know,
good shot at it.
But you know what's not hard to pronounce?
What? Goodbye? I'm much too good at goodbyes.
Oh, wow. I know that's a song, right? Yeah.
Sam.
Oh, yeah. I haven't listened to that album yet. But I have listened to numerous episodes of Showbiz Sandbox, which you can do too if you subscribe to our show on iTunes, the Google Play Store, Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, wherever you get your podcasts is where we can be found. And if we can't be found in one of those places, please do write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com, or call us 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Follow us on Twitter @showbizsandbox is our handle. Like us on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox. All that information is on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find links to all of the stories discussed on today's episode. Again, the website is showbizsandbox.com. You'll find the ways to subscribe to us there, and please do rate and review us in those podcast aggregators. It does help us out. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Gilt has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's justonemorething.com.
Oh, a reference to Columbo. Oh, I got it. Okay. Well, if you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry there, why not head on over to michaelgiltz.com, where all of his work is aggregated, or the Huffington Post. Of course, don't forget to check out bookfilter.com so you know what you should be reading. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. And until possibly next week, play nice.
Yeah, pay attention to social media. Sperlin will let you know if it's not happening.
That's true. And I see here you have actually, in the show notes, laid out how I should pronounce. I can't even pronounce this now.
It's a very hard name to say.
Sephora Yokesberger.
May she rest in peace.
Happy Thanksgiving, Michael.
Oh, happy Thanksgiving, Sperling. It's like the Waltons or something.